CFMU, redefining radio in your community.
And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU, broadcasting to Hamilton and the community and the rest of the world via internet at cfmu.mcmaster.ca. And like I was saying before the program, once again, we are privileged to have Zafar Bangash with us. He's an Islamic scholar, writer, and community leader. He served as editor of Crescent International. And I wouldn't want people taking Zafar for granted. He's someone intimately connected with the media, Western reporting from Central Asia. He follows what's happening in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Palestine, what's happening with regard to Iran. So it's a time where a lot of information is slipping through the cracks, and there's few people that can bring us the wealth of information and depth of analysis that Zafar brings. And today, as I said earlier, he's joining us to discuss Lebanon, specifically the trial over who killed President Hariri and other issues, especially how the media's framing it. We'll move on from there, looking at the role of the international community in Lebanon and its future. So let's see if we have Zafar with us. Zafar, can you hear me?
Yes, Brandon, I'm with you.
Oh, wonderful. You're coming in loud and clear.
Okay.
Okay, so that's very good. I'm glad to have you with us. Like I was saying earlier, we're going to be looking at Lebanon primarily today and some other issues. And this is a very peculiar investigation going on now, because we know that on Valentine's Day 2005, President Hariri was assassinated. It was an event with major implications in Lebanon and abroad. And for some people, it seems like they're treating his assassination as if it's a gift that keeps on giving. And so now there's this UN, supposedly this international tribunal in Lebanon established in 2007, or it's also called the Special Tribunal for Lebanon. And they said that the assassination was definitely, almost certainly conducted by Syria. That was broadcast very loud and clear to us for some time. And they trumpeted that idea, I guess, everywhere. It was used to build support for the idea of severing ties with Syria. We can get into all that. But now they've moved on and they're saying, well, maybe it wasn't Syria. It was perhaps a Hezbollah member. Yeah, now it's a Hezbollah member that killed President Hariri. So now Hezbollah can be targeted too. So, I mean, how is it that they can be pretty sure it was Syria and tell everyone, and now they're saying, it was Hezbollah now? How does that work?
Well, first of all, it was the former Prime Minister, Rafiq Hariri. He wasn't actually the Prime Minister at the time, but he was the former Prime Minister who was assassinated on February the 14th, 2005. And, of course, the U.S.-Israeli objective at that time was to force Syria to withdraw its troops from Lebanon by making those wild allegations against the Syrians. And, of course, there was mass hysteria whipped up in Lebanon. Naturally, the assassination of a former prime minister, one who was well-known internationally, and in fact he had done quite a bit for the development of Lebanon, because Rafiq Hariri himself was a billionaire. Incidentally, you know, I'm not sure whether many of your listeners would be aware of this, but he also had a Saudi citizenship. So while he was the Prime Minister of Lebanon, he carried a Saudi passport, and through that, of course, some connections with the Americans as well. But that's a side issue. The real point was that Hariri's assassination was used to force the withdrawal of Syrian troops from Lebanon that had been there under an agreement with the Lebanese government dating as far back as 1976, because there was conflict, a civil war in Lebanon, and the Syrian troops were there to restore order and to keep the warring factions apart. Now, that, of course, was achieved in the first phase. So once the Syrian forces' withdrawal from Lebanon was achieved, then this allegation that Syria was involved was no longer useful. So now they have come back to say, well, no, it wasn't Syria. It was Hezbollah, and we have proof because we have got these cell phones and cell phone communications, etc. Now, one of the things about these whole cell phone communications is that the Lebanese government itself has complained to the International Telecommunications Organization that their cell phone network and telecommunications network is deeply infiltrated and manipulated by the Israelis. And so the United Nations Special Tribunal for Lebanon is actually using these alleged cell phone communications, which are manipulated and interfered with by the Israelis, as evidence that perhaps some members of Hezbollah may have been involved.
Well, it seems this special tribunal has a problem with information gathering. I was reading an article by Franklin Lamb, and he was saying that there was an incident where the tribunal perhaps violated procedure when it came to get documents from a gynecology clinic. A number of people were protesting that instance, and I know the U.S. ambassador has been somewhat upset over the way that this has been perceived. The whole trial is fraught with controversy. Is it true? Did they detain four Lebanese generals without any evidence or charge for a few years?
Absolutely. They detained them, and then they had to let them go because they found out that there was absolutely no proof against them. And then, in the meantime, of course, if you have had several years of chasing mirages, and then all of a sudden you discover that the people you have under custody are not involved, but you have not been able to go after the real culprits, then you know that whole evidence or that whole period of investigation becomes redundant. And in fact, that is precisely what has happened in Lebanon. That earlier on, allegations were made that were completely unproven. In fact, false testimonies were given, and that was accepted by the tribunal. And then later on, it turned out that that was completely erroneous. So the whole tribunal procedure is actually grossly tainted. But we see that naturally the U.S. and its allies like Britain and France are behind that, and behind the scenes are the Israelis, who want to use this tribunal to convict or to indict anybody within Hezbollah, because their real objective is to disarm Hezbollah and thereby destroy it. Now, although Hezbollah is presented as a terrorist organization, but it is a legitimate political party in Lebanon. It has 12 members of parliament in the Lebanese parliament, and it is a very important component of the Lebanese political scene. Additionally, Hezbollah runs a number of clinics and other social services projects for all the people of Lebanon. So it is much more than a military organization, although it is a military organization because its avowed aim is to expel Israeli forces that are occupying Lebanese territory illegally. And there are, incidentally, United Nations resolutions that demand that Israel should withdraw from those places unconditionally. One of those resolutions is, in fact, Resolution 428, dating back to March of 1978. And Israel has flatly refused to comply with that resolution. And there are at least 60 other Security Council resolutions that Israel is in violation of, but nobody talks about that. And here we find that this Special Tribunal for Lebanon, as it is called, has been set up, and the authority for that tribunal has been taken away from the Lebanese government. So although the matter revolves around Lebanon and its former prime minister, as far as the conduct of the tribunal is concerned, Lebanon has absolutely no jurisdiction. It has been completely taken away from their control. So we can see that this tribunal is actually not a fair tribunal. It doesn't serve the interests of Lebanon. The current Lebanese prime minister, incidentally, Saad Hariri, who is the son of the assassinated prime minister, Rafiq Hariri, he has openly said that Israel's role in the assassination of his father needs to be looked into. Wow. He's the son of the assassinated person, and yet the Special Tribunal on Lebanon pays no attention to his statement, even though he's the prime minister of the country.
It seems that this tribunal is very outside or imposed. Hezbollah, you mentioned Hezbollah, and any serious investigation or reporting on Hezbollah, whether it's from the West or from Asia or from wherever, it notes that Hezbollah is a serious political actor in Lebanon. There's a number of important political actors, organizations, movements, and so forth. You've sort of already answered this. In terms of the tribunal and its representation, it doesn't look like this was exactly voted in or elected by Lebanon's citizens. And you know, there doesn't seem to be an international tribunal for Israel, an international tribunal for the United States. So once again, it's a country that's been victimized time and time again that ends up facing a tribunal like this.
Exactly. I mean, you know, this whole tribunal was manipulated right from day one. The Lebanese parliament, the Lebanese government, the Lebanese people have had very little say in how it should conduct its business. And even when it was pointed out repeatedly to the members of the tribunal that its work was being manipulated by outside forces and that wild allegations without any substance were being made, the tribunal simply ignored them. And then 4 years later, as we talked earlier, four Lebanese generals were arrested and kept in detention for nearly 4 years. And then later on, it was found out that they had absolutely nothing to do with the assassination or any involvement in the assassination of Rafiq Hariri. And yet, the tribunal still continues to bulldoze its way. It actually releases well-placed leaks in order to create the impression that it is going after the real perpetrators of this crime. And one other point that I think we really need to consider is that whenever any incident like that happens, if somebody is assassinated or any drastic things like that happen, we should always ask the question, who benefits? Now, if we examine this question, then Rafiq Hariri's assassination, number one, did not help Syria. In fact, it was used to cause a major setback to Syria. Number two, it did not help Hezbollah in any way, because Hezbollah had absolutely no problem with Rafiq Hariri. In fact, at that time, Rafiq Hariri was actually planning to visit Syria to mend fences with Syria. So his elimination, in fact, prevented that mending of the fences with Syria, and it caused great damage both to Syria as well as to Hezbollah. And the only parties that benefited from that dastardly crime were the Israelis and the Americans. So motive in any crime is a very important consideration, and we cannot exclude that in this case as well. So I would say that if the tribunal really wishes to do its work properly, then it cannot ignore these crucial aspects as to who benefits from a crime and go into the details and try to investigate.
I remember those details floating around at the time of the assassination, the fact that he was looking to visit Syria for the rapprochement with Syria, and the fact that Syria didn't really seem to have a major problem with Hariri. And so you have a situation following from that, as you mentioned, where Syria was then targeted by these tribunals, by the media, and so forth. Following that, now Hezbollah. I mean, maybe next we'll learn that Iran or North Korea had been involved in the assassination, the way it's going. But as you say, there's a very good chance United States, Israel may have been involved, and it's a possibility very much worth discussing, especially when you consider their approach to politics in that area. It's not discussed in the mainstream media, even though any wild theory about Syria, Iran, or Hezbollah will be accepted, right? This tribunal will allow almost any discussion about Syria or Hezbollah.
That's correct, yes. In fact, what has gradually evolved over the last few years is that now there is a close relationship between Iran, Syria, Lebanon, Hezbollah, and Turkey. And this is of great concern to Israel as well as to the U.S., because the U.S. feels that it is gradually losing influence in this region with the emergence of this new bloc that is going to pursue a more independent policy. And for Israel, because for decades Israel thought Lebanon was its playground and it could go and do whatever it liked, and with the U.S. it could install and implant whatever regime it wanted. It could initiate civil war in the country, as it is actually planning to do now. Because if, let's say, this tribunal were to indict any members of Hezbollah in Rafiq Hariri's assassination, then the argument and the propaganda that would be advanced would be that here was a leading Sunni figure in the Muslim world, in the Middle East, that was assassinated by a Shia organization. So it would inflame Sunni-Shia tensions and might even lead to civil war in Lebanon. And in fact, when we see that over the last several decades, Hezbollah has been trying very hard to lower any sectarian tensions. And in fact, it has earned the respect of all communities in Lebanon because of the great work that it is doing in terms of providing social services, hospitals, daycare centers, rebuilding people's homes that have been destroyed by Israeli bombardment and so on, which are, incidentally, are war crimes, but nobody talks about that. And so this move by this special tribunal that is being manipulated by the U.S. and Israel is in fact meant to instigate civil war in Lebanon. But I am quite confident that Hezbollah is capable of thwarting these conspiracies and frustrating these attempts by Israel and the U.S. to instigate civil war in Lebanon. And Hezbollah has already said that they are prepared for a series of responses. They have considered all of the various scenarios and that they would confront each and every one when it comes. Well, and in the meantime, of course, you know, the Americans continuously push that some of their people go to Lebanon and warn the Lebanese officials that Israel is serious about Israel is serious about attacking Lebanon, as if that's the normal thing to do. I mean,
yeah, you can get releases now and then on Associated Press or from Israeli newspapers saying, you know, government considering ramp up of actions or escalation of actions towards Lebanon, a possible strike against Lebanon, possible strikes on Hezbollah location. Like you see a discussion of possible future actions. They're promoting that idea.
Right, exactly. As if this is something perfectly normal when it is not. I mean, these are actually acts of aggression, and they should be condemned by the United Nations. I mean, if there is any rule of law in this world, surely these kinds of threats ought not to be tolerated, and that all these governments that go gung-ho and become sort of completely, go berserk, if let's say Israel were attacked, or if let's say Hezbollah were to say, or Hamas were to say that we are going to attack Israel, the whole world would be up in arms, and they would be condemned as, instigating violence and promoting terrorism. And that here is Israel constantly threatening Lebanon and Hezbollah and Iran and the U.S. as well, and the U.S. and its officials and its members of Congress and their media go around talking as if that is the most natural thing to do.
Well, you have some Israeli politicians that say things like, we'll do better with Lebanon next time, we'll win the war next time.
Yeah.
So they want to change the situation and the status quo. Well, overall, or just looking at the situation overall, it seems that following the assassination, the actions of this tribunal, the investigations have basically served to further isolate or weaken, divide, as you have suggested, Lebanon. And certainly it does seem to be trying to remove ideas of Lebanese independent direction, of independent politics in Lebanon. It's kind of an attack on the legitimacy of the idea of Lebanon or Lebanon as a state.
That's correct. You see, the U.S. and Israel see Lebanon as the weak link between Iran, Syria, Turkey, and Hezbollah. And so they feel that if they were to exert immense pressure on Lebanon, and if, let's say, Hezbollah were indicted by this tribunal or any of its members, and a demand was made of Lebanon to hand over these people for trial at an international tribunal, and if Lebanon were to reject that, then punishing sanctions will be imposed on Lebanon, even perhaps more severe than those that Iran is currently facing, again on completely ludicrous allegations about its very legitimate and peaceful nuclear program. And the thinking is that the Lebanese people will not be able to bear the cost of these sanctions because they are used to an easy life, unlike the people of Iran who have been in the throes of a revolution for 31 years and they have had to face a major war for 8 years, and they have suffered sanctions. So they've been toughened by these difficult conditions. And in any case, Iran is an enormously resourceful country. It has great resources, and it can weather these sanctions and these storms. But Lebanon, which is a much smaller country of 4 million people, and it is divided along sectarian lines between Christians and Muslims, and the Muslims are also divided between Shias and Sunnis, etc. And then there is interference from the Saudis and other Middle Eastern countries instigating one party or the other. So Lebanon is very vulnerable. And so the thinking is that if the tribunal were to hand down a verdict that implicated any members of Hezbollah, then if the Lebanese government did not comply, then that would lead to punishing sanctions. Now, if the Lebanese government were to go after Hezbollah members and try to arrest them, that obviously would lead to conflict in society and might even erupt in civil war. So from the point of view of the Americans and the Israelis, they have a win-win situation in whatever action or whatever consequences follow after the so-called indictment of Hezbollah members.
Right. You know, it's interesting. What I got from the article by Franklin Lamb in Counterpunch is, aside from the fact that this tribunal doesn't have a lot of welcome in Lebanon, it's also frustrating for the United States in particular to compare the reception of the tribunal in Lebanon to, for example, when Iran's President Ahmadinejad visits. In that case, there was a lot of excitement, especially once trade came into the picture, billions of dollars worth. So it seems all the international community, so-called, can offer is punishment for Lebanon, where other countries can offer something more substantive.
Exactly. In fact, it was incredible, the reception that Iranian President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad received in Lebanon. He was seen as a friend and as an ally whose country had given billions of dollars in aid to Lebanon to rebuild the country. And then he signed a number of agreements to set up plants, etc., in Lebanon that would provide employment opportunities for people and something constructive for the Lebanese people. And what the U.S. and Israel have given to Lebanon so far is war and threats and misery. So the people of Lebanon know who their friends are and who their enemies are. That is why the reception that President Ahmadinejad received was, in fact, even greater than the reception that John Kennedy had received when he visited Berlin back in 1962 or 63. So you can see that the Lebanese people know who their real friends are. And certainly in Lebanon, there is absolutely no respect whatsoever for this tribunal that is seen as nothing more than a tool in the hands of the U.S. and Israel.
You can see there's events happening here that are of great significance, and we're just not hearing about it here in Canada. And there's other things we're not hearing about much either, and I guess I should take a moment to just look at that. I know something that I wanted to speak with you about was just the continuing strikes in Pakistan, the continuing use of drones, robot drones, because here in Canada we had received some newspaper articles and news reporting on the television about the use of robot drones or remote-controlled drones to attack what they call suspected terrorists. And there was some outrage over that and some uproar, but it's kind of died down. It's become a sort of issue from the past, and people seem to have forgotten about it as if it's not happening. But I understand the strikes have basically escalated year after year. Since beginning 2004, it's gone up since Obama got in. There was 100 strikes this year alone, at least. It was a weekly occurrence and then a daily occurrence. So it's really a growing issue, and I wanted to just take a look for a second at what they're actually doing, because we're using the word like suspected and terrorists. So on these suspicions or on evidence or information brought in by others, strikes are being conducted. There's no trial. There's no photos or pictures. I don't think there's any evidence. So basically you can just order a drone strike and blow up a house. Is it that simple?
Oh, absolutely. That is what they are doing. In fact, over the last couple of months, the UN representative for Afghanistan has actually said that these drone attacks are illegal, number one. Secondly, there have been, over the last couple of weeks, demonstrations held outside Pakistan's parliament building in Islamabad by people whose relatives have been killed in these attacks. And these people have said that our brothers, our daughters, our wives, our children have been murdered by the Americans in these drone attacks. In fact, all the evidence shows that more than 90% of the victims of these drone attacks are civilians. So these, in fact, constitute war crimes. There's another angle to this as well, and this is something that your listeners perhaps should pay attention to, and that is that in war, there has to be people who are waging war ought to be identified as to who are the people that are waging war, who are the ones that are pulling the trigger. Now, you see, if you look at the situation in Afghanistan, and particularly the case of the Canadian Omar Khizr, who is languishing in Guantanamo Bay, one of the allegations against him was that he was not wearing a military uniform, and the Taliban did not used to wear military uniforms, so they could be captured, and they were enemy combatants who did not, who were not protected by the rules of war. They could not be considered as prisoners of war. Now, here we have the situation with U.S. drones, where these U.S. military personnel and CIA officials sit in the United States, and they just press computer buttons and fire missiles on people's homes and on people in crowded areas and towns and villages in Pakistan, and they murder people, and there are no pilots on those in those drones because these are pilotless planes. These people are faceless people. They just sit on computer boards in America. So they are in violation of the very rules that the U.S. used to convict or to apprehend hundreds of Taliban fighters, and particularly Omar Khizr, that he was not wearing a military uniform when he was engaged in fighting. So this is something that I think we need to pay attention to, that these drone attacks are illegal, that they are killing innocent people in Pakistan, that the family members of those victims have now started to protest. Some officials in the UN themselves have started to raise concerns about this, although I have very little hope of the UN because it is basically an instrument that is manipulated by the United States for its own purposes. So I have little hope in the UN to do anything about it. But the fact that a UN official would feel sufficiently concerned to raise his voice about these things indicates how serious the problem is. So it is definitely a war crime that the U.S. is involved in against innocent people in Pakistan.
And I guess it gets worse. I'm told now that it's expanding into Baluchistan, the region rich in natural gas. According to Fatima Bhutto, whose article I was reading on this, it shares a border with Iran, as we know, and this is the new growth area for these strikes. So this seems also politically or geopolitically dangerous as well.
Absolutely. In fact, this is what the Americans want to do. And I wouldn't be surprised if the Americans have already launched drone strikes inside Balochistan, which is a very volatile region. As you mentioned, it's part of Pakistan, but there's a province of Iran as well bordering it, and Afghanistan. And there is, in fact, an insurgency going on in Balochistan against the Pakistani government because of the high-handed manner in which the people of Balochistan are dealt with. And there is a separatist insurgency going on there, and if these drone attacks continue, then the chances of that insurgency intensifying will multiply. And, in fact, there is a long-standing U.S. policy. This has been reported as far back as 2005 and even earlier, that the U.S. would like to separate Balochistan from Pakistan and also incorporate into it the Irani side of Balochistan, because this region is very rich in minerals and the U.S. would like to lay its hands on. And Balochistan is also the province on whose border is that very critical deep seawater port called Gwadar, which was built with Chinese help and which has been leased to China for its trade. So there is a road link from China through the northern mountains of Pakistan coming into, through Pakistan into Gwadar, and from there Chinese goods are shipped to the rest of the world. And the Americans are very keen to grab hold of that seaport because it's only 50 miles from the mouth of the Persian Gulf. So imagine if American forces were occupying that, they would be able to bottle up all sea traffic emanating from the Persian Gulf. So it poses a major threat to Iran's shipping. The U.S. would then control all trade into Central Asia, because that is where all the trade goes through from, and it would also be able to control the entire Persian Gulf region. So there's a very big game being played at the present time, and it is part of the American strategy to escalate the conflict in Balochistan so that it would prepare the ground for breaking up Balochistan of Pakistan as well as Balochistan of Iran, to create what is referred to as a greater Balochistan to serve America's geostrategic interests.
Well, it's certainly a very energy-rich, mineral-rich, and volatile area, and something not to be treaded on lightly. And I'd just like to say, there's a lot of ignorance here in terms of North American media, in terms of what we're consuming. You can find this information in bits and pieces. You can read 100 different articles, but it's very hard to put it together unless you're spending all your time doing so. So that's why we appreciate you coming on the program. There's not many other people that can do this, and you've put it all together. And again, we just wanted to say that we very much appreciate you being on the program to do this.
It's my great pleasure. And incidentally, I can direct your listeners to our website as well. They would find much of this information on our website, which is crescent-online.net. And we provide information about these things on a regular basis, so I'm sure they'll find a lot of useful information there.
Crescent-online.net.
That is correct.
Okay, well, thank you for providing us with that information, and thanks for keeping up Crescent International. And again, we'll catch you with more of these issues as they come up. And thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much, Brandon. I appreciate that.
Thanks, Zafar.
Take care. Bye-bye.